Surrey County Planning and Zoning Commission to order.
Be a roll call, please.
Steele.
Here.
Cable.
Here.
McBride, absent. Merkin.
Here.
Smith, absent. Holstrom, absent. Sherwood.
Here.
Great. Are there any changes or additions to the agenda for this evening? Hearing none, the agenda will stand approved. Are there any changes or additions to the minutes from our previous meeting? That would be May 3rd, 2016. Hearing none, the minutes from May 3rd will stand approved. We now have time for public comment. For any members of the public to offer comments concerning matters that are not scheduled to be heard already tonight. Anyone like to offer any comments on any issues not on the agenda? Okay, we'll move on. Our first case tonight is CUP 06-17, temporary construction and demolition landfill site. Emily. These guys are going first. Oh, I skipped right over, didn't I?
Yep.
Let's back up to item number six, discussion of Surrey County transportation issues. Darren Moon and Tony Filippini.
Yep, you got it.
Who'd like to go first?
What kind of?
Or would you like us to introduce anything? Or I think essentially we just wanted you guys to come in and share what was new and talk about how we can interact, how we should be interacting on development issues, particularly as regards transportation in Surrey County.
Okay, Jerry asked to come and talk at least about how we plan in our office, and that's kind of why we brought Tony as well, because he has a different kind of planning for the region. But as far as the county goes, we have a five-year construction plan. That's what the map is back here. And I'll go through some of my slides. We meet once a year in about February or March with the board to go over the plan once a year and adopt it by April 15th. And it's to meet this code section that we have to adopt a secondary road construction program and send it to the DOT for approval. And this is a little bit different than a long-range type of plan. It is a construction program as if these things are going to happen in the next 5 years. Is kind of what it's for. It's not a wish list. This is what we plan to do. We don't get into long-range plan in the county. That's more in the MPO and RPAs, and that's what Tony will talk about in a little bit. So I had 152 slides here. I'll just hit on a couple of them. I won't take long time. Yeah. This is what I presented to the board. But I wanted to point out the first one, I already commented, the programming should be based on the amount of money we have to spend. It should be a wish list of programs. It should be what we can actually accomplish in the next 5 years. All kinds of factors we take into account when we put projects in the program. And of course, the last one, are the funds available, seems to be the biggest one for us. We have multiple funding sources, and this is a sheet from our local construction program. Just local dollars, that's our tax levy. We also got the road use tax fund, we have the farm market fund, and then we have some federal aid funds as well. But we only had three projects in FY17 because the one is so large, the Grant Avenue, and that is all local dollars. Typically, our local construction budget is only around $500,000 a year. But with that fuel tax increase of 10 cents, we banked that for 3 years. We get an additional $600,000 in the local fund each year from that 10 cents. So we banked 3 years to do that grant project from Gilbert to Ames. Otherwise, that wouldn't have happened. We just didn't have the funding to do it on a local road. But the next year, FY18, we just approved that. That's got a lot more projects than the vast majority are all bridges. There's an overlay on West 190th, but the rest are all bridges except for that grant, which is a carryover project from the previous year. That's what the program looks like when we submit it to DOT. That's not a very useful form, so I put it in this format for the board. It's too small to read, I understand, but we go over the projects with the board, and if they had a number here, that means they were included in the five-year program. And beyond that is just kind of a wish list. That's where we kind of get into the long-range planning with the board and say, here's a list of projects we'd like to do. Do you want to bump them up into the program or leave them down here in the wish list? And actually, there's a number of these paving jobs. I'll show you a map later that the board actually bumped up into the program, brand-new paving jobs, which is rare for us. That's our biggest issue is funding. The last time we paved a gravel road was 15, 16 years ago. We just don't have the money to do that, and now we've got four or five of them in the program all of a sudden. We're doing two of them this year. This is the two slides I want to point out. The board doesn't like these because maintaining pavements isn't very glamorous. You know, you want to build new stuff and improve things, but we don't even have the money to maintain the system we've got. That's what these two slides point out. We have 202 miles of pavements, 36 miles of PC pavements, 166 of HMA, which are the asphalt pavements. Putting a design life for each one of those, you come up with, you need to be doing almost 8 miles a year. And to do that, you need just over $2 million. Next slide kind of shows our available funds. Most of our paving funds come from our farm market account, and STP is our federal aid dollars. Add those available funds up, it only comes to about $1.4 million. We put a little bit more of local dollars into that, but we're still short of what we need just to maintain the system that we have now. So we're falling short of that. And the bridge side is even worse than the paving side as far as funding goes. I try to point that out to the board every year. Here's a couple maps of the paving that we had in the program approved. Most of these are just overlays of existing pavements, but like I mentioned, we do have a few new ones. This is 600th Avenue, which gets closed next Monday for paving. And then Grant up here is Gravel Road now. We're going to pave that and put the bike path on the east side of the road to connect Ames with Gilbert. And all the rest are just overlay parts of existing pavements. They did add three more pavings after this map was made. I'll show you those when I get to the wish list. They were bumped from the wish list to the paving program. There it is. This was the wish list that we'd like to pave, and they bumped 13th Street right here. With Ames Annexation, there's some thought maybe that railroad crossing in Holbs could get closed at some point with some new railroad spurs and stuff, so they want to pave all the way out on 13th Street to the co-op and down. So that was added into the program. A couple of sections of 560th down here by Huxley were added into the program, 1 mile stretch of gravel here, and then we're partnering with Huxley to pave 560th up into town. And the other gravel we added was this University straight south. We're doing one stretch of University paving next spring, and then we're going to pave the rest probably 4 or 5 years from now. We're not sure if we're going to go this direction or this direction, but we added south into the program. But all the rest of those are just paving wish lists. We get into bridges. I'm not going to get into bridges too detailed, but I'll show you the map that we ended up approving. This is all the bridges that ended up in the program. The yellow or green ones there are the ones in the FY18, and the blue ones are the ones further out in the program, but there's, I think, 28 bridges there in the program. For the most part, yeah, we end up with a program. That's what you see here. This is the approved one that they came up with, and we submitted that to the DOT, but for the most part, that's the extent of our planning. Jerry mentioned this is probably the area you're mostly concerned with traffic-wise, and that is our heaviest traffic area, and we're getting some congested areas starting, especially here on GW Carver and Cameron School Road. Past few years, we've had a lot of discussions with the board on what we do with this area, and some discussions through the MPO on maybe some possible new routes, but that's really long-range type stuff. Our board discussed possibly putting a new road because I wanted to reconstruct North Dakota. It's not really a through route. It's more of a local type of road with no shoulders and stuff, so we looked at possibly building a new road here to get the traffic off of North Dakota, but when I gave them the cost estimate, they decided not to do that. This is one of our bigger, newer subdivisions here, Cameron Estates, adjacent to a gravel road. And we're doing a bridge replacement this year on the paved portion of West 190th. Once we get that complete, we're considering vacating this stretch of gravel road. That's a floodplain area. And that would pretty much, this road wasn't, the paved portion of West 190th wasn't brought up to a paving standard when it was paved. It's got some really steep hills and it's a really low speed, so we don't really want to make that a through route. So that's another reason why we want to close that, other than the fact it floods every other year, it seems like, and washes out the road. And it would take some traffic off of the Cameron Estates 505th gravel road. We are putting a, I wouldn't call it a turn lane, but the shoulder of Cameron School Road and GW Carver, for people that are turning southbound there. The shoulder's wide enough to get off onto it now, but it's rock, so it gets really potholed. We're going to pave with asphalt some of that shoulder. It won't be very long-term lane, but at least keep some of that traffic out of there and won't be so hard to get through with the potholes. That should happen this summer. And then, of course, the Irons is adding a new stub road off the other side, which is essentially going to make that a four-way intersection now, so it'll be even more complicated to get through there. We're watching the warrants for a four-way stop are nearly met. You need 500 vehicles per hour for an eight-hour stretch, and we're not to that yet, but it's getting close. And there's so much turning movement there, northbound, turning left on the Cameron School, that really backs traffic up. There's possibly some future development there that could get annexed as well, so that it could be an Ames intersection before too long. But that's what we don't like to do, is our funds are so limited, we don't like to pave roads around real close to the city, because they'll just annex it right up, and then we kind of lose our investment there in the road. But we had no choice on Grant. It was getting so much school traffic, we had to do that one. But we probably expect that will get annexed up and melt fairly soon, be our guess. But those are our main issues right now. Any specific questions about any of our planning?
Yeah. You mentioned the bike path on the Grand, this project you're talking about here. You said it was only on one side of the road. So is that a separated path?
It's completely separated. There's a couple stretches where we're getting in front of houses where there's a paved shoulder in between the bike path and the road, but it's still separated by 5 or 6 feet.
So how wide is it?
The bike path itself is 10 foot wide.
So it's two-way.
We're concerned with the traffic. This we call Moose Road, West 190th here. Does not stop through that intersection. And the bike path is going to come down on the east side, and then we got to cross, and then I believe the Ames is going to bring their bike path up on the west side. So we're going to cross Grant at a stop sign, so that won't be so bad. But then we got to cross West 190 with high speed traffic, and it could be a lot of school age children. So at this point, we're really considering doing a four-way stop there for safety of the bikers, because you put a flashing light there with cars going 55. There's other counties that had issues with that. They see the flashing lights, they slam on the brakes, and then they get rear-ended. It's not a good situation, so I think we're just going to make a four-way stop. It's on its way to development anyway in the future, I think. So.
You said one of the factors in your planning is development levels in the area. What do you, are you going by traffic? When you say development levels, do you mean a certain traffic count generated by the development? Are you a certain number of lots, a certain number of, and what's your measuring stick?
For the most part, we're pretty reactive developments. We don't know about them usually until they're about to happen, so we're reacting to it. If it's a big enough development, we're going to require a transportation study so we know what kind of traffic it's going to generate, and then we go from there. We haven't ever, like cities do, they come up with a development agreement saying you got to pave this road if you're going to develop here. The county's never done that. Most counties don't do that. There's probably something in this area we're going to have to start looking at, and whether that's even legal for counties to do, we need to look at. because it's difficult. Say this area develops more, and they're going to have to put, you know, stoplights and all kinds of pretty costly improvements there. Is it fair just to charge that development or all these developments? You can't really go back and charge the previous developments, so that gets difficult to do.
Has there been a development in recent history that you can remember where you were close to saying, look, this won't function unless there's a major improvement at this intersection or this, and then how would you convey that? Because, I know that you see things in interdepartmental review, but
with counties, it's pretty rare to have something that won't be functional. We're out in the open area, and the traffic counts just are not high enough. Like I said, it doesn't. That's our busiest right there at GW Carver and Cameron School, and that still doesn't quite even meet the four-way stop points. So definitely would need to stop by one thing like that.
Is there a level of service you're trying to maintain?
Yeah. It's been a while since that study. I can't remember what they ended up for level service in that intersection, but it seemed like it was going to function fine. The church one was kind of interesting as well. Their traffic study, but that one they didn't have real concrete, what kind of traffic was going to be generated due to the church, and it's really grown, I think, even more than they planned. So that one, and out here to E3.
So we got one more, and then I'll shut up. Anyone else ask? So I'm gonna put words in your mouth here. Are you saying so when we see a new development and we're concerned about the level of traffic that's going to generate potential turning problems and that sort of thing, are we just reacting to the relative change and overall, as far as textbook on paper, it's not that big of a deal? Because some of these seem like they're a big deal to us, but it could be just because it's going from relatively low to a big bump up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and even then, I think what we struggle with those is, are we just saying, okay, you can't do the development because it's causing a traffic problem, or do we go to the point of saying, we've never went to that step. I think we thought it wasn't legal for the county to require you to improve this intersection. Cities can do it, but we're not so sure counties can do that. So it'd be to the point, if we determine that intersection is going to work, it's pretty much telling the developer, no, you can't do the development, period. We need to figure that out. It's getting to that point in that area. We need to figure out which direction we're going to head. If we're going to put these requirements for improvements, or if we're just going to say, no, you can't develop because it's going to cause this problem. We haven't tackled that yet.
So you don't have a definitive answer as to whether or not the county can require developers to assist in roads or street improvements?
I do not. Jerry, you know if Polk County did that ever? I've always been told the counties couldn't do it like the cities do it, but we've never went check with the county attorney to find out for sure.
I would presume the county attorney could do the research.
That'd be our next step with that.
That might be useful if we're getting to that point, because, and I heard you say it, and I understand what you're saying, that you're kind of, the county's kind of reactive.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, but at the same time, when we have so much development going on in an area, and we're confronted with, requests, for subdivisions, whatever, and we know what it's going to bring, it's really kind of hard to sometimes look at these applications and say, yes, let's recommend that when we know what the traffic already is. And
I don't think we've really got to that point yet where the traffic studies show a level service problem. We've got to the point, like on 505th, where, boy, do we want the development right next to a gravel road with all the dust, and do we require them to pave it or not? We've debated that side of it. We obviously let them do that there, but we never got to the point where there was a traffic issue that we felt we shouldn't go in because of it. But the traffic counts are raising pretty quickly out there to the point where the next one might be to that level, or the level service won't be good.
Well, the other thing I also think about is if land is being purchased for development, and if we're thinking 10 or 15 years down the road, we say that might be, we might need turn lanes here, a roundabout might be a better solution than a four-way stop. isn't the, and I don't know exactly how it would happen, but it seems to me that that would be the time to secure the land, make it a condition, you know, of something, just secure the land. It's easier to do the improvements if you've already got the land for them. But if you're already having people building right up to, you know, your streets, then you've got to move things and all heck breaks loose.
We have really kind of relied on when those things do happen, that's when the city's been annexing it, and then they require the developer to take care of it at that time. So one of them are going to come up, but we can't rely on that, I'm sure. But
would it be easier if the city of Ames just annexed this land right now?
I don't know if it'd be easier. Just like I said, our funds are so tight that it's hard for us to develop. They just, the money isn't there to do developments like that with county money, unless the board found another funding source. So we don't get, like I said, too proactive to go out and look and plan ahead, and we're not sure what's going to even happen in the area.
Is there a way to develop some scenarios and then use the NPO's travel demand model?
I would say that's kind of what the NPO does, and they do include this area in their studies, so Tony might hit on some of that. The NPO boundary goes well outside the city limits for their studies. So. But then, like I said, that's
then we can range. We could look at the level, you know, say, you know, make a scenario saying how much we anticipate the development in this area, and then look at the level of service of these roads. With the travel demand model.
I think that's there already. It's just then what do we do with the data?
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to see that data. To see what's anticipated with the scenarios that the MPO has come up.
It's 500 vehicles per $8. Is that for all county roads and district roads?
That's pretty much just a flat warrant for a four-way stop. Yeah. And that's that 500 is traffic in all directions, not just one direction.
If there are more questions for Darren, we can let Tony kind of expand on this conversation and show a lot more for both of you.
Well, good afternoon, commissioners. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you this morning, or this afternoon. My name is Tony Filippini. I'm the transportation planner at the Ames Area MPO. So this is close to 100% of the work that I do. So for everyone's benefit in the room, I'm going to take a couple of minutes to talk about what the MPO is, and then we'll get into the planning process for the regional transportation area, as well as some of the projects, or the projects that are currently both planned as well as funded through the MPO. So just to start with regional context, the Ames Area MPO is on the western side of Story County. I'm sure many of you are already aware that a majority of Story County is part of the regional or the rural planning affiliation, which is known as CERTPA, the Central Iowa Planning Affiliation. That's, I believe a lot of those meetings take place in Des Moines. So a portion of it is now in an urbanized area in the Ames area, Ames being the regional center for this. So to get through, the MPO more specifically includes the city of Ames, most of the city of Gilbert, and includes Story County as well as a portion of Boone County to the west. The MPO areas are, this is part of a federal mandate that they include what is anticipated to be urbanized in the next 20 years. So Ames and Gilbert are in it, and then the what's anticipated through 2040, which this came, so this is based on the 2010 census, so in 20 years would be 2030, which is the minimum for the planning that we're required to do. We currently go out to 2045, which I'll get into. So I say that because you are certainly aware of the Ames Fringe Plan. I just wanted to bring that up, that these are two different things, or they're not totally aligned with each other. So the Fringe Plan is based on state allowances, whereas the urbanized or the MTO planning boundary is a federal mandate rather than through state the state legislature. Just to go back to just the Ames Area MPO is a body all to itself. So there's a policy group and a transportation group. All of the jurisdictions are part of that policy group. So Story County Supervisor Olson is the Story County Supervisor that's part of that policy group. They're the decision makers for the Ames Area MPO. And then also under technical committee, Darren is for the Story County, but also includes Boone County, as well as the Iowa State University and Cyride, all the jurisdictions and transportation providers in the area. So the Ames Area MPO, all MPOs are required to have a long-range plan, which I alluded to is has to be at least 20 years. Ours currently was adopted in October 2015, and it goes out to 2040, which is 25 years. It's a little bit above and beyond what is mandated. Every 5 years, we're required to adopt a new one. So in 2020, we'll have to do this again, and we'll start that planning process in next year, really, in 2018. We spend really between 18, it could be up to 30 months, depending on what our planning process is. So it's a continuous planning process. What I want to show is when we go through this planning process for our long-range plan, it's developing regional priorities in all modes, and this is part of the federal mandate as well. So the things that we're showing here, just to give an example, are these are projects in both from roadway transit needs as well as bike and pedestrian facilities. This is a culmination of participation from either the agencies telling us what their needs are, the public. We did through this planning process, public forums, pop-up meetings. If we had a focus group that we counted on, as well as your more general public meetings that people could come to and do some activities. So through that, our long-range plan developed the vision, it developed goals, and all of those projects were prioritized using all these visions or all these vision statements. So eventually what that means is we developed a list of projects for the region that are going to so the areas that we've got for the Ames area under this plan really look at connectivity, safety, the impact on the natural and built environment, being context sensitive, economic impact, and then finally the maintenance of the current system. These are six areas that were found that all the projects that were submitted were sort of, if they met more of those requirements, they would rise up. And if they really didn't meet those or were contrary to our vision and goals, those projects would either drop out completely or be very low priority. So I want to get through and just chose the illustration. I've got some reference material a little bit later, and I can't soak it all in. But what we do have is a number of project pages. So this shows our roadway projects that were selected for the metropolitan area. This plan is what you'd call fiscally constrained, meaning that it's reasonable that in the next 20 years we'll have the funds to process or to finance these projects. It's looking at all the funds that would be used for this area, both federal as well as the state or local funds that we can that we typically can rely on. From roadway, we also have a whole series of bicycle and pedestrian facilities. This was from our public, a very big focus in this project, so much so that we broke it into two groups. So we have our on-road systems, which would be improvements to the roadway where people could do more biking on, and then also an off-street, which is much more focused on more your green belt and trail system, and also a big focus was how do we connect to the Central Iowa rail or trail system as well as our regional trail system. Something that I wanted to touch on as well is I know that the C2C plan was developed after that this plan is developed. So I highly anticipate that in our next rendition of this long-range plan in the next year or two, that we'll be incorporating those recommendations that came out of the C2C so that we've got stronger regional and county coordination with that trail system and greenbelt system to connect to the greater system there. Also, finally, we've got a list of transit plan projects. These, just as a sort of a caveat, this level of planning, we don't get into service planning or times or how often the bus runs or even routes, really. This is looking at large federal investments. So this is additional right-of-way or vehicles or major facilities. That's where that would show up in this plan as well. So what we do have available is an interactive map that's available online, which you can click on any of the projects on this map, and it will give you more information about sort of the general planned prices that were developed, very, very cursory prices, sort of the general near-term, long-term type, sort of where we go, and if there are any planned notes that were part of that as well. So, and this is something I'll pass along too, so you can have this for future reference. It is available on the Ames Area MPO website. The website generally is just aampo.org. So all the regional planning documents are available there as well. I thought it'd be worthwhile to talk about funding a bit. So sort of the purpose of the MPOs is to make sure that federal investments are locally coordinated and are appropriate for the area. So we do get some federal funds through formula grant processes. The Service Transportation Block Grant is that one. It's a competitive grant process for all the agencies within the Ames Area MPO planning boundary. We get about 1.6 annually to appoint to these projects. These projects must be contained in the long-range plan. That's how you ensure that it is a regionally coordinated plan and that it does go through the transit or the transportation demand model and various other models and analysis to ensure that it's regionally significant and is an important part of the network. So beyond that, there's also what's called the Transportation Alternative Grant. These are grants that are generally geared towards trails, not capacity building projects. This is also a competitive grant process. It's much smaller, only about $70,000 annually. This is something that the MPO policy group will make a priority list, and then the state will select those. And then finally, the MPO is, by and large, it's a planning agency. So it does get about $130,000 from the U.S. Department of Transportation to do these planning activities. All these are federally mandated activities, such as the long-range plan, the Transportation Improvement Program, which is actually the program document, and the planning document. So with that, we do have our next 4 years of their service transportation funds programmed. These are projects that are submitted on the competitive basis and awarded as they correspond to the long-range plan. So we have, over the next 4 years, sort of what you see is the regional priority is in the Grand Avenue Extension in Ames. This has been programmed for many years and takes a large sum of the money just due to the scale of the project. So that's definitely been a regional priority. And then from there, it's projects such as a lot of pavement rehabilitation for maintaining the current network. So that's what you see in the next couple of years there. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm sure I didn't answer everything or make everything crystal clear, but happy to fill in some blanks. So.
So you said the creation of South Grand, taking South Grand to South 16th is in the plan.
Yes.
Are there any, is everything that is in the plan within the city of Ames?
No. The other projects that would sort of go out of the City of Ames at this time is the Iowa Department of Transportation is doing some work on Interstate 35. So there's federal funds that's required to be in our plan area. So that's included as well. But at this time, Ames is the only sponsor that has asked for funds.
We're tasked with considering development proposals all over the county, but most of those pop up around Ames. What interaction should we have with the Planning Commission with the MPO? Are there moments when you see something that is approved in the county where you go, oh no, this doesn't work, that's horrible? What level of cooperation should we have? Should it be at the planning level? Should it be at the day-to-day consideration of individual development proposals?
I'd say definitely the planning level. I'd say one of the large tasks that we do at the very beginning of the long-range planning process is developing that traffic demand model. A lot of that is sort of anticipating what the land uses are, what what the near-term and what the long-term idea is, even just generally speaking, is that more of an employment area, is that more of a residential area? And so that really helps educate with that model so that we can just be a little more scientific, or maybe not scientific, but a little more clever in our forecasting.
Is there any value for the MPO or any value the MPO can deliver to us in reviewing the development proposals in advance? Like we have an interdepartmental review that all of our proposals are routed to. Is there any value in you receiving that and just even giving a cursory review of what's about to be considered? It's okay to say no.
Yeah, just trying to think, because I'm not sure at that level, beyond maybe just referencing what might already be in the long range plan. There may be projects that are identified adjacent to or within those plan or those project areas. I think at that point it might be worthwhile taking that into consideration when looking at those developments.
Does the planning staff consult with you on issues like what Darren mentioned on planning proposals, development proposals, subdivisions? Does that stuff get routed to your
They do not. So
that might be a comparison.
So the Ames Mobility 2040 plan, does that extend to the urban fringe?
No, it only extends so far as the blue line, which is a bit more closer to the Ames city limit than the fringes.
Do you have an overlay to the urban fringe?
I do. There we are. So what's in color is what's in the urban fringe area, and then you can also see the blue dashed line that's sort of in the middle of that fringe area.
The blue dashed line is it? Okay.
Yeah.
So how is that? Yeah, how is it decided what the MPO boundary is?
Yeah, so the MPO boundary is reconsidered after every U.S. Census. And after the U.S. Census, the new urbanized area is determined. And then from there, we have to designate what the next 20 years of the urbanized area would look like. And so typically at that point is when it would be updated.
You imagine it's
going to
change quite a bit?
I'm quite curious. I don't know. And, there's certainly, I used to practice in Texas, and more of a common thing was they would just pop out to the entire county. So, I don't see that as a practice here in Iowa. I'm not totally sure. Well, they have a lot of growth happening, so that's probably why. I feel like they had a county every time I look at their website. But it's fairly small here.
Just out of curiosity, obviously I see the membership list here, but do you interact a whole lot with any of the other surrounding communities, I guess, in Story County, in terms of, I guess, looking at future planning?
Yeah, I don't. Our area, just Ames and Gilbert. Certainly, if there's interactions between our technical committee members who may have worked with them, those get brought up in those meetings. But we don't do any direct interaction with communities outside the MPO area.
I will say, for the most part, the MPO is a mechanism to distribute the federal funds. Although they do that type of planning, that's required to meet the federal guidelines. That's why they don't get too involved with city staff and their development stuff, because there's not a lot of overlap there.
But they do have the travel demand model, correct?
We do.
And you're able to run new scenarios through the travel demand model?
Excellent, yeah.
So with the travel demand model, what kind of threshold of units or housing units or, you know, parcels would kind of change the level of services of some of these roads? Do you, I mean, is it 50, 100? Would you know anything like that?
I'm not so sure I'd give an answer to that.
What we use is typically that one house generates 8 to 10 trips a day. So, 10 lot subdivision, an extra 100 vehicles per day on that road is.
But with the travel demand model, it's looking at more of the complexity of the situation. The other roads that are being fed in and out of the area. So I would be curious to see what scenarios are out in. Maybe I could just read your plan to find out. But the scenarios in that area between Ames and Gilbert, to see what the planning horizons, see how the levels of service change.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's definitely in there. The large level of service issues were largely on the primary highway, so Interstate 35 and Highway 30. So, and I'll mention too, for our travel demand model, something that's new for this plan is a fairly robust transit component. So it definitely creates a lot more complexity and with the student population. And so there's a much greater mode shift to match the actual demand. Otherwise, the roadway would probably look much more heavily used than it actually is, just due to the amount of riders on SciRide, especially in West Ames. So those are definitely scenarios that we can run, and it would tie right into that whole system.
So I think if we did have, a large-scale development come before us, it would be interesting to plug that scenario into the travel demand model, if that was all possible, just so we could see the data.
And what would you call large-scale?
About 50, 100 houses.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
That's just my opinion.
But the problem is, you could end up with 50 or 100 more houses, but not just in one development. It might be four or five sequentially over the course of a year or two, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, that just incrementally built to a level that if we had seen it come in one fell swoop, we would have said this is significant. That's what I'm trying to get my arms around, how we figure out where that's going.
Because even if we can require developers to shoulder some of the cost of the improvements, you can't just stick it on the most recent developer, because the problem has been preventable buildings.
And it has, but at some point, you say, how are you going to do it? I would be really interested in seeing what the county attorney would say about what the county can require developers to do. Because if you know there's a possibility of doing something, then you can start talking about what might be, what are some options. And then developers also know.
Yeah.
So there aren't surprises. Or fewer, I don't know.
I think if it's clear to developers, they're willing to do some improvements. But if it's not clear, then...
Work plan, Jerry.
So if we could see an opinion from the county attorney on impact fees and excising the impact fees for the county.
Yeah, that would be good. Okay, any other questions for these gentlemen? Thank you so much for giving us some of your evening. I appreciate it. Darren, I would say to you, we really do need your comments on the interagency reviews, and they come up all the time. They're really valuable. So I would just encourage you to write whatever your thoughts are on them, even if there's not some magic threshold met that says, whoa, slam on the brakes. Even if it's just, this is getting close, this is a potential issue, this is a potential concern. Even if it's not something that can trigger an improvement, we'd still love to hear what your thoughts are. Because oftentimes we're posed with planning commission, how can you go over the top of your county engineer and say there's a transportation problem, if the engineer didn't note in his comments that there's a transportation problem. So just really any broad thoughts you have are really appreciated. Okay. Any other questions, comments?
It was very useful. Thank you.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to move on to the first case of the evening, then, CP06-17.
Okay, the application before us today is an application for conditional use permit. The applicant is Manats Incorporated, represented by Chris Son. Manats is based out of Brooklyn, Iowa. And the subject property is in Section 13 of Washington Township. The property is two separate parcels. It's the smaller parcel is zoned commercial light industrial, and the larger 40-acre parcel is zoned A1. So just a little bit of background on this. Story County Planning and Development learned about this site and its happenings when the City of Ames inquired with us about material excavation and storage on the site. We held a conceptual review meeting on April 27th, and then Manats applied for a conditional use permit for temporary construction and demolition landfill site. So back in 2016, a floodplain development permit was issued for an agricultural building on this site. That has not taken place, but in early 2017, Manats removed the topsoil from approximately 5 acres of agricultural land on the northeast corner of the property. The topsoil has been stockpiled on the south edge of the site, and then 2 acres of the site have been elevated to meet the requirement of being at least 18 inches above the base flood elevation for development within the 1% chance floodplain. So I also include on here that the land evaluation site assessment score is 191 for this site. The construction demolition landfill site conditional use is not to be allowed in the A1 district when the LISA score is above 267. So the nature of this request is for a temporary construction demolition landfill site. This would include stockpiling about 15,000 tons of milled asphalt and broken concrete, and it would go through November of 2018. There would be a crushing component to this, and it would take place on the site with a portable crushing machine in late summer, early fall of this year, and it would be about 2 to 3 weeks of in length. Existing materials on the site have come from the City of Nevada's 6th Street project, the I-35, there's an I-35 project, a resurfacing project in southern Story County and northern Polk County, and then the I-35 Highway 30 interchange project. So
the eventual crush material that they are hoping to produce on the site would be for two DOT projects on Interstate 35, the resurfacing and then the interchange project. In the event that MNATS applies for additional projects in the area and is granted those projects, an extension of the timeline may be granted for the use through a new conditional use permit application or a modification, depending on the request. So, here we are in Washington Township. Here's I-35 here, Highway 30 here. Oops, I'm sorry, I-35 here. Sorry. Highway 30 there. We're in the southwest, kind of the southwest corner of that interchange there. Again, so the zoning on the northern parcel, this is Dayton Avenue here, Highway 30. The zoning on the northern smaller parcel is the commercial light industrial, and then the 40 acres there is zoned A1. We do have some A2 zoning about a half a mile away, but other than that, it's all zoned A1. You can see this is immediately adjacent to the City of Ames corporate limits, which come here. In terms of the comp plan, or the in this case, the Ames Urban Fringe plan designation, this property is designated rural urban transition area and also natural areas. And we'll get into what that says in just a little bit here. So here's the overall site. The total size is just over 50 acres. The impacted area is about 5 acres. Currently, some of the property, about half of the property, as you can see, is in a wooded area. And then the other half is in row crops. The site is fully within a FEMA flood hazard zone area. So this is the site plan here. The entrance is at the intersection of South Dayton Avenue and Southeast 18th Street. There are currently two piles of materials, the broken concrete pile here and then the milled asphalt pile here. It's anticipated that there'll be more concrete than can fit in this current pile, so they've designated another area for the concrete there. The topsoil that was removed before the pad was created, before the site was built up out of the floodplain, is located on the south side here. It has been planted with grass and silt that has been put on the south side. The crushing machine, when that comes into play, will be located here. And the future crushed concrete pile would kind of take over this area here. Employee vehicle parking would be in this black box here. And then some of the other equipment, the track motor, will be located there during that work hour, and the excavator would be near the crushing machine. There are some site photos. Here's the site entrance in Southeast 18th Street, looking at northwest here. Looking east along Southeast 18th Street, straight ahead would be materials and that excavation site there. Here, looking northeast from the southern property, there are the current piles. Here is South Bay Point here, and then Highway 30 would be back there. So, looking northwest from the site, you can see the car dealership across 30 there. Looking east, I'm sorry, west. That is the area that you can see was excavated, the topsoil was removed and piled there, and then this portion of the pad was built up. Here's the pad again on one end of it. Again, the
program that you created here. Again, looking south, again, you can see the silt fence that they put in on the south side of that curve. We need some subject property, again, for health materials here. This is starting to show where the City of Ames recently issued a special use permit for an act to do an asphalt and concrete batch plant on the old truck site. There are trucks on 30, right off of 30. And so that is within the city limits, and so that's within the City of Ames jurisdiction to allow that. Okay, we'll be east and across Alpine Avenue again. And then northwest towards Highway 30, you can see some little hotels on the north side of the property here. But we do have a frontage road that goes on the east side of the property and wraps around the north side. That this road will remain open through the entire project. This is images of the equipment to be used on the site that were provided by the applicant. This is the SL crushing plant. It has several components, but it's a portable plant that they use on a lot of different sites. Here's the excavator that you might expect to see on the site, and then the track holder. So in terms of standards of approval for conditional use permit, this project, in terms of compatibility, this is a temporary use. There will be no permanent structures constructed. Close to extraction sites that are located directly to the East and Mount Materials and OMG Midwest. Temporary asphalt and concrete batch plant is located at that old truck stop that I said before, then the City of Ames. And then there's rural crop production to the south. Transition. The stockpiles are visible from US 730 and Dayton Avenue. There's a wooded area to the west of the site, that natural wooded area that's there. And then Highway 30 is on the north side, which is built up with it. And the top silver located the on the south side of the property. The City of Ames Gateway Light Sculptures. I know there's quite a bit of investment in that area, but they're about a third of a mile to the east of the site. So this is traveling east on Highway 30. This is a wooded area immediately to the west of the site. And then here's directly north of the stockpile on 30. You can see them here, is the asphalt and the concrete there. So you can get an idea of what it looks like from Highway 30. In terms of traffic, the applicant estimated that there would be approximately 150 truckloads per day, or about 300 vehicle trips per day, just during peak hauling hours. So when they're bringing in the crushed concrete and asphalt, and then when the material has been crushed and they're exporting it back out to different sites. This estimated is about 1,800 truckloads in total for the whole project. The hours would be 6:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. We would see an increase of traffic on the road, but it would be a temporary increase. And we feel this project is essential for the I-35 project to be completed. Here's a haul route provided by the applicant. I-35 here, Highway 30 here. One of the comments we received in an interagency review was that this westbound exit off of Highway 30 going to Dayton Avenue is going to be closed for the summer for construction. We asked for a haul route for the project, and this was provided as an alternative, obviously, when the Dayton Avenue exit opens up again, they will use that. Instead of exiting here, they would continue to travel down 30, take the south exit, parking and loading, in terms of parking and loading, it will all take place outside of the right-of-way on private property. Employee parking will be on the south side of the site, like we've been there before. The general public will not access this site or park on the site. And the applicant anticipates, in general, when they're stockpiling, that there may be one employee reporting to the site, and during material crushing, there might be, there will be about 5 employees maximum. In terms of time and length, all of this work will be taken care of, be completed in the daytime, so no exterior lighting will be used. Staff is recommending that truck turning signage should be required for conditional use. In terms of environmental protection, silt fencing, as I showed before, has been installed on the south side of the site. A floodplain development permit is required for this project, and as a part of that, a flood evacuation plan will be required and need to be approved by the floodplain coordinator and the emergency management director. The NAC has DNR permits for the installation and modification of air efficient sources, that's for the portable crushing plant, and then National Blue Discharge Elimination System permit for NDES. There's a maximum of 913 gallons of petrochemicals on the site, and the equipment holds about just under 500 gallons of fuel in total. So this is looking again at the silt fence looking west here. So, if the commission concludes that all the above development criteria will be met, it must recommend approval of the application unless it concludes that if completed as proposed, there is a strong probability that the development will, number one, not adequately safeguard the health, safety, and welfare of persons residing or working in adjoining or surrounding properties. There's no single-family dwellings immediately adjacent to the site. Again, it's located next to 2 extraction sites to the east. And then there's that asphalt and concrete patch plant to the northwest. Number 2, impair and adequate supply, including quality of light and air to surrounding properties. The crushing machine is set up with water spray bars to suppress the concrete dust. That's something that's required by the Department of Natural Resources and part of the permit. Dust is expected to be minimal. And again, the duration of the crushing will be about between 2 to 3 weeks in late summer and early or early fall. Number 3 is unduly increased congestion in the roads or the hazard fire, flood, or similar dangers. The existing traffic is primarily related to the extraction use directly to the east there. The increase in traffic from this from the temporary asphalt concrete batch plant that was recently approved by the city of Ames will also increase traffic in this area. We are going to hear tonight another proposal for an asphalt concrete batch plant on the east side of 560th Avenue, about half a mile to the south. That would possibly increase traffic. But again, this temporary increase in traffic in the area, we feel it's necessary to complete the I-35 project. Number 4, diminish or impair established property values on adjoining or surrounding property. We don't anticipate any negative impacts on just surrounding properties. And lastly, number 5, not being part of the intent, purpose, and spirit of the land development regulations or county cornerstone capstone plan. So within the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, as I mentioned at the beginning, this area is designated rural urban transition area. This designation includes a policy that should permit interim development to occur in a manner that will support long-term urbanization of the Ames Urban Fringe. The proposed construction demolition landfill site will help in this urbanization and rural projects in and near the city of Ames. And I will support your presentation. This area is also designated natural area within the an anchor retention plan. The goal of the natural air is to mitigate negative impacts to natural areas, including but not limited to agricultural chemical application, animal confinement, feeding, agricultural irrigation, other agricultural activities, manure, fuel storage, outdated non-functioning on-site wastewater systems, underground storage tanks, and nutrient-loaded urban stormwater problems. This project will comply with best management practices from the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual and the Iowa Statewide Urban Design Specifications as required by certain regulations. The topsoil has already been planted with grass to minimize erosion. The southern portion of the property will continue to be farmed as is. And again, there's the silt fences all along the south side. Lastly, anchor and fringe plan. We have an anchor and fringe plan policy to locate future development outside of flood hazard areas and where flood development is allowed in the flood plain. Require the development to be elevated as it's flood proof and located outside of the floodway. This is a temporary site that's elevated already out of the floodway, and the applicant will need to get a floodplain development permit from the county equipment coordinator and work again on that flood evacuation plan with the floodplain coordinator and their management director. So just some comments from interagency review. Again, they will need the floodplain permit. Restrooms will be required to be anchored. We will work with the applicant on these things specific to the floodplain. Emergency management and questions about the hauling route. The exit on the gate is closed, so that they wanted to know what the plan for that was. They were interested in what kind of chemicals and how much people live on the site. Planning and development asked several questions about the specific projects involved and if the NAS is interested in doing more projects. This offers of crushing different equipment that will be on the site is more specific on their application. Comments from the public, public notification letters were mailed to surrounding property owners regarding this meeting today. And we did receive a phone call from a resident with concerns regarding the flooding in this area and the potential for this project to increase the flooding. So just a few points to consider regarding the conditional use permit. The proposed construction and demolition landfill site is a temporary use. Any impacts will also be temporary. It is necessary to accommodate uses that support the long-term growth and development of the anchor and fringe area. Historic Land Development Regulations, Chapter 90, Conditional Uses, require the construction, demolition, landfill sites in the A1 district to have land valuation tax assessment score less than 267 as code 4. And the lease for this property in 1991. The proposed site is near other extraction sites. It's that asphalt concrete batch plant approved by the mains and was in very close proximity to the I-35 Highway 30 interchange. Planning about the staff support recycling and reuse of the materials and the project is essential to completing projects. A floodplain permit will be required for the temporary construction and demolition landfill site, including a flood evacuation plan for the equipment, and that's a condition of approval. So, planning development staff recommends approval of the conditional use permit for the next temporary construction and demolition landfill site based on site review and information provided. The staff report here. Materials provided by the applicant as the ordinance conditional use permit 0617 with the following conditions. This conditional use permit will expire on November 30th of 2018. If an extension of the use is requested, a new application for a conditional use permit or a modification to CP0617 would be required. The gravel pad shall be allowed to remain on site for up to 1 year following the expiration of the conditional use permit, at which point the area must be restored to its original condition if they have not applied for a conditional use permit during that time. The applicant shall submit a flood evacuation plan to be reviewed by the County Soil Plan Manager and Emergency Management Director as part of the flood plan development permit. And then number four, parks turning signage should be required during major hauling days. All signage within the right-of-way will need to be approved by the Iowa Department of Transportation or the City of Ames, depending on the location of the signs. So here you go. Alternatives. Again, staff is recommending approval with conditions. Any questions?
Why isn't the hours of operation included on the conditional use?
The hours?
Yeah, hours of operation.
We just asked that question. It's not like, we just asked that question, so we know if it's like a night project or a daytime project that has some of the site lighting as well. It's just additional information.
I'm a little worried about the noise of that. Was that in any of the considerations, the area of hotels or anything like that?
I think we're about a half a mile from the hotel, so it shouldn't be too bad over there. There's a lot of construction going on in the area.
Yeah.
An actual crushing will be a 2 to 3 week period.
Okay.
The duration.
Okay.
So late summer, early.
Okay.
And aside from the trucks turning signage that's going to maybe be part of this in terms of moving it forward, are they planning to have any other type of signage just alerting folks to the fact that this project is going on in terms of that major hauling time where Dayton's going to be closed? I'm just wondering in terms of traffic flow, what that could potentially overall do, and just, you know, sometimes they pre-warn folks like construction is going to be occurring or if there's major changes to, that could impact traffic flow, you know, if they're planning to.
Yeah, that would be probably a good question for the asking. That's absolutely a possibility that the community could ask for.
Okay.
And I think, yeah, we'd be happy to.
Just to deter, you know, maybe commuters or whoever to take a different route home, just, again, to try and mitigate some of that traffic.
Yeah, and the hauling isn't going to be throughout the entire time.
Right.
It would just be when they're stockpiling and then when they're taking
material. Right.
And what were the hours again?
6:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. on major Friday.
And 300 vehicles?
300
trips.
Yep.
So that's 25 trips an hour. So, I wonder if we have to
know. There definitely will be an increase in traffic there, although it will be temporary.
Staying 2 to 3 weeks a bit.
That's when the crushing will take place.
Okay.
I think,
and they'll be transporting it material back.
Yeah, they'll be transporting, and that might.
Do you know why this site was chosen rather than a site maybe out in the county that would be a little less near all this traffic?
I think that this is very close to the I-35 project.
Mm-hmm.
This was again an existing site that had already been using. They understood that a conditional use permit was required. Again, there is also extraction uses in the nearby vicinity, and then that asphalt and concrete batch plant
Okay, so that's why the soil was already moved and all of that was done, because they didn't really realize they needed a conditional use permit. That was my other question. Well, here's one more. Milled asphalt, that has high oil content?
I know there will be some petrochemicals on the, I'm not exactly sure as to the oil content, maybe Chris could address that.
Because I can see where, okay, you've got, you know, you've got equipment there, you hear there's going to be a flood, you get your equipment out, maybe you can get any above ground gasoline storage out of there, but you're not going to get a huge pile of milled asphalt out. And I just wondered what's in that, what does that mean if there is a flood and that gets flooded, does it leach into the soil? It end up in the skunk, you know, what's the possible environmental degradation in that, particularly being so close to the river?
And that might be also a question reserved to the floodplain development permit. That you can add that. That
would be a question. Any other questions for staff? Would you like to speak on behalf of the applicant? If so, if you could step up to the podium and give your name and business address, please, for the record.
Chris Song with Manat. I'll try to hopefully address some of the questions that have already been asked. As far as the specific location, why it was chosen, the traffic there really isn't that heavy. There, I think there's one residence down that road. Otherwise, it's just construction traffic, which is our traffic at the temporary batch plant, and then Hallett Materials truck traffic coming in and out of there. So I don't believe any impacts on people going that direction. I don't think there will be any impacts on residents. Oil content as far as flooding, yeah, we can't address that with our flood plan. But typically, with asphalt, to get the oil out of asphalt, it needs heat, and that's how you extract the oil from asphalt, is with heat. Turn it back liquid, I guess. So. Am I saying anything you disagree with?
No, it won't come out at 90 degrees. It won't come out to 101.
So soaking in water and then water draining off, and that the water won't carry residue with it.
What about silt?
The
acidity of the water.
The site right now, well, we do have some silt fence. Are you talking about silt?
In a flooding situation.
Uh-huh.
If the site became flooded, would silt come off the site and go into the water?
Certainly more, no more so than it would as a agricultural field. That is very sandy soil. As of right now, there's very little to no runoff on site. Any water that lands there goes down. I mean, it's there's a sand pit just down the road that they're mining sand. There's very little runoff. So, but in a flooding scenario, I suppose silt could move. But again, as a farm field. It depends, I guess. You'd have to, if you really wanted to control silt, you'd be having to fence the whole farm field. And then at that point, how big of a flood are we talking, you know?
If I can interject, that intersection of Main and 18th, is it? That intersection there, I've never seen it underwater. And that's the elevation that we're trying to see for that lot elevation.
The elevated portion where our stockpiles are right now and where our crushing equipment, all of our equipment will be staged, is to the elevation of Dayton Avenue, essentially. And as he stated, we're not aware of it ever being underwater, which is part of the reason we thought it to be a good location.
Chris, just curious, so when the Dayton exit closes, do you guys have plans to offer signage of some kind to alert, like, traffic that's generally coming in and out, that there's going to be some hauling going on that's going to be rerouted?
Typically, no. Right now, well, the Dayton Avenue exit's closed right now.
Okay.
And as far as the DOT requirements on signage, they would handle all of that on their contract end of things, notifying of ramp closure or detour. And on a primary system like Highway 30, they don't necessarily even care the amount of traffic that you don't put up, I guess, signage for primary routes typically. And 150 loads in a day's time is really nothing on 30.
Is it there enough? Are they still used the 100-year and 500-year floodplain designations? So for somebody who's used to the older nomenclature, this is kind of like a 100-year floodplain, which means it does. I've seen 100-year floodplains. So.
And again, this has been elevated already 5 foot, approximately, from that 100-year floodplain. So it's up there above that floodplain that we'll be operating on.
Other questions for Anthony? Thanks, Jim. Any questions or your thoughts?
Thank you. Yes, sure.
Go ahead.
I've got this last time, too. Yeah, let's open the floor to public comment, please. Please step to the podium and offer your name and address.
Okay. Name is Donald Schumann. S-C-H-U-M-A-N-N. I live at 3209 Jewel Circle, Ames. Zip code's 510. That's in the southeast part of Ames. It's about for those of you who know where Lowe's Home Improvement Center is, from Lowe's, I'm a half a mile south, a half a mile east. I can walk out and look out the back of my house and look down over the South Skunk River floodplain. My wife and I bought a lot that we built a house, moved into it in September 1968. And there's been numerous times over the years when we had lakefront property because we got the floodplain just to the east. All we got to do is walk down a slope and we're down into the floodplain, and we've had water up there I don't know how many times over the years. But our house is sitting about 16 or 17 feet above the highest water level that we've had. I'm a graduate of Iowa State University with a Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering. The reason I want to tell you a little bit about myself is because I have lots of experience dealing with highways, floods, dams being built for that people direct water in different directions. I graduated from Iowa State University, Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering in 62, became a registered professional engineer in 1966, And I was until just 2 years ago when I decided not to do professional engineering work anymore. And I had my license, I let it expire because I didn't want to be spending money to have it renewed. I worked for the Department of Transportation as what was called a resident maintenance engineer for approximately 34 years. I was not in the main office building. I had an office east of Ames. My area of responsibility was near Belle Plaine in the southeast corner, Dyke, up near Cedar Falls, northeast corner, Humboldt, northwest corner, Woodward, the southwest corner. I was responsible for the maintenance on the primary and interstate roads in that area. Floodwaters over pavements, over highways is a big problem. I dealt with US 30 being flooded and closed to traffic because of the South Skunk River flooding in 1963. Dealt with it again in some of the years, I might be off a year or two. The next time that US 30 was closed because of flooding of the South Skunk River was 1995 or 96. I'm not sure which year for sure. That was a mess. Well, and at the same time, those 1993 and again in 95 or 96, Interstate 35 ended up being closed because of flooding in the South Skunk River also. The city of Ames, in both those years, both those floods, you couldn't get across the country in the Ames area because in Ames, Lincoln Way, East Lincoln Way was closed, floodwater. 13th Street was closed because of floodwater. Riverside Road up by the Martin Marietta Quarry was closed because of floodwater. You had to go clear up towards Story City. If you were going westward on US 30, you had to go up to Story City basically and take a county road over west quite a ways and then back down south to US 30. I-35 got to be a real headache because when that was closed, the traffic didn't have a lot of roads. They had long detours to go around. Some of them clear over on US 65 at Colo to get around. When the DOT and the city of Ames finally decided because of the hazardous intersection of Old Dayton Road and US 30 needed something done. And that started in the late 1980s to build an interchange that was further west from the Old Dayton Road US 30 intersection, at grade intersection. The interchange that we have today of US 30 and South Dayton Avenue was in the planning stages in the late 80s. It didn't actually get constructed until I think it was in like 1994 and 1995, finished up in 1996. Again, I might be off a year on some of that. But there was two things that in the proposed interchange. First of all, is because of safety. At the old intersection of US 30 and Old Dayton Road, numerous people were killed there. Many people were injured. There's lots of crashes. I witnessed one myself where two people were killed, and that is because they weren't using their seat belts. If they had used their seat belts, they probably would have had some bruises, but they would have been alive. Another one that I witnessed and helped pick up the remains of the man riding a motorcycle. Semi pulled out of the old cyclone truck stop when it was an at-grade intersection with US 30. This semi pulled out, was going to go west on 30. There was a motorcyclist ahead of me, probably a quarter of a mile or half a mile ahead of me, heading east. The truck pulled out. The motorcyclist didn't get stopped. He ran into the trailer, about in the middle of the trailer. Most of the motorcycle and part of his body went underneath the trailer. The rest of his body, the upper part of his body and some parts of his motorcycle were against the side of this semi-trailer. But that brought about them getting this interchange built.
Mr. Schumann, can I ask you to bring it back to the case at hand and back to how, I know you're headed to an important point, but if you bring it quickly to how it impacts this.
Okay, I will. I'll get around to the second reason for the interchange. And that was not, safety was the first part. That was the important part. The second part was to try to design this interchange and build it in such a way that we weren't going to have flood water closing it anymore, closing US 30. And that was pretty well accomplished. The city did a lot of work to the north with building South Dayton Avenue up to keep flood water that's accumulated to the north from going over US 30. The problem then became flood water that went underneath the bridges of US 30 and went out to the south. Some of it spread out to the west, some spread to the east. What spread to the east was a big concern when the design was being done for the interchange and while the construction work was being done, because we wanted to keep the flood water that spread out to the east of the South Skunk River from coming back and getting back into the interchange and over the ramps and closing the main line. And it was designed so that probably flood waters wouldn't do that, wouldn't get into to the interchange itself. Now, the fill that was put in, somebody put fill in this area that we were talking about a little bit ago. Back, I think, is in the year 2011. They changed some of the drainage for flood water when they did that. So in 2012, August 2012, and in 2015, and again I think it's in August, floodwaters went over the south end, the South Dayton Avenue, went over it, washed out the shoulder on the east side of that road, went down into the area where the cyclone truck stop used to be. And the reason why the floodwater did that was because somebody put a bunch of fill in this area we were just talking about. And as I understand it, they did not have a permit to do it. Now, Jerry, is that right? Was there a permit issued for anybody to do excavation and filling?
We're not aware of any submittal.
Okay. You're not aware of it. Okay.
For that northeast.
Yeah. But that changed the drainage.
Similar project.
It shouldn't have been done. Shouldn't have been done.
And are you concerned, Mr. Schumann, that this project will have a similar effect?
It needs to be corrected. And it's not a big matter to correct the problem that was created in 2011. I can't imagine it costing a whole lot of money either. And it should be a part of this thing now. The fill that's in there wasn't put in with a permit. I guess I question why wasn't a permit applied for and issued to them in 2011? The other thing is OMG Incorporated, that owns land between the fill area that we were just talking about and the Manatch property to the east. In 2011, they purchased OMG Incorporated, purchased the land that's in between to the south of Southeast 18th Street. In 2011 or 12, somewhere in there, they built a dam all along the north side of their property, the west side of their property, the east side of their property, and a little bit lower dam on the south side to keep floodwater from getting in where they were going to start an extraction operation. The dam is built higher than the city's southeast 18th Street.
Mr. Shoup, I'm going to ask you to wrap up here in the next minute.
Okay. But I have a great deal of concern about some of the changes that have already been made, what's being proposed about the floodwaters and impacting adversely the property where the old cyclone truck stop was, because it could impact on US 30. And the other thing is the unsightliness of stockpiles of material that's left for years. Now, I think I saw that somehow that it'd be removed within a year's time. What's created now would be removed in a year's time. The other thing, every year, the DOT has a patching contract to patch the pavement on US 30, Interstate 35. The patching contractors generally occupy the area in question. And do they need a permit to do this? And do they get a permit? Or can they do it? Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any other comments from the public on this proposal?
If I may, there's...
Can you step to the podium, please, and give us your name and business address?
I'm Dwayne McDonald from Brooklyn, Iowa. I'm an employee of Manatch Incorporated, and there's never been any crushing on the site in question. This is the first time there's ever... We've had a pile there before, crushed it, and it's gone, and we're starting another one. But I want to remind everybody here that on the north side of this property, there is a frontage road that has elevated grade. It's not a ground level, which is a deterrent of water. Of course, it's got to go around that roadway to be able to come back in. And I'd also like to remind the committee that the new bridge span over Interstate 30 that's under construction right now is much taller and much wider, with ability of much more volume of water going under it.
Thank you. Anyone else like to speak on this issue? Okay. Body question?
Yes, I'd like to move to approve the conditional use permit 0617 with the alternate number 2.
Is there a second?
Second for purposes of discussion.
We have a motion by Cable and a second by Merkin. Discussion on the motion? That motion is to go with staff's recommendation, by the way, for the record.
Can we go back to the floodplain manager comments for the interagency review?
Yep, and the floodplain manager is here if you have any specific questions for her.
Could she address the gentleman's comments here?
Could I add one more minute later?
No, we close the public hearing, so we're going to proceed, please. Go ahead, Ann.
Good evening. I will say good morning. I'm Leanne Harder, the County Outreach and Special Projects Manager with Story County, but part of my responsibilities is does remain floodplain management. To address the question about the initial fill, yes, there was a permit issued by the Planning and Development Department at that time. There was a preliminary development. There was an agricultural exemption issued for an ag building, and then to coincide with that, there was fill allowed, which is allowable according to the National Flood Insurance Program. Story County's regulations, however, exceed the minimum National Flood Insurance Program. We require elevation at least 18 inches, which is substantially lower than Ames, though. They do require for flood protection 3 feet. So in cases where we do allow fill, and it's for a structure of sorts, that fill is required to be 18 inches above base flood elevation. What are your specific questions?
There'll be tie-down requirements too, correct?
Yeah, anything that is potential to float downstream, they'll have to be anchored. So portable toilets, tie-bows. I do have some concerns of potentially trying to create a barrier for to prevent siltation in a flood event, because that siltation, that silt fence itself may then break free and go downstream and cause an obstruction that would, similar to a log jam, it could help create something where we're trying to prevent something, it could result in something worse downstream. That would be something I talked to DNR about, but generally we don't do that.
Do you have concerns with the piles flooding? Actual materials?
The materials? It's allowable under our code and under the minimum regulations. And I do rely heavily on the expertise of the state's floodplain management staff, and if they say it's okay, I'll go with that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jerry. Just to verify, Jerry and Emily, acquiring a floodplain development permit is a condition attached to altering or to, and without acquiring that permit, they can't proceed with the CUP, with implementing the CUP.
Can't be a part of it.
Okay.
And so, I can't issue a floodplain permit without a CUP.
Okay.
Because I'd be issuing a floodplain permit for a land use that's not allowable under the current regulations.
Right. But if the Board of Adjustment grants a CUP, but they're unable to obtain the floodplain permit, there's no way to implement, because it's conditioned to CUP, there's no way to implement or take action on the CUP. Any other questions for Leanne? She's at the podium. Now's your chance.
I don't come very often anymore.
Okay.
Thank you.
We have a motion and a second on the table to recommend, in accordance with staff's recommendation, approval with conditions to the Board of Adjustment. Let's go ahead and call for a roll call vote, please.
Merkin.
Yes.
Cable.
Yes.
Steele.
Yes.
Holstrom.
Yes.
Sherwood.
Yes.
Motion is approved, and your CUP application will be considered by the Board of Adjustment. Staff will want to do that. Thanks for coming in tonight. And we're moving on to 7.2, which is CUP05-17, Drummond Act Temporary Asphalt Matching Plant Facility. We're not straying too far geographically.
Wow.
Right down the road. Here.
Okay. So this is an application for a temporary asphalt batch plant facility. Again, right down the road. It's on 560th, which is kind of what South Dayton Place turns into, I think. The applicant is Joseph Manat. And the operator of the temporary asphalt batch plant is Hennington Construction. The property owner is Doris M. Plath. And so we have written approval from the property owner and the operator for Joe Manat to apply on their behalf for this permit. Again, the nature of the request is a temporary asphalt batch plant. This is a picture. It's a portable plant, so this is what the plant looks like at another site. Hennington's Construction owns and operates the plant. It will operate until October 2017.
And it will operate in the night time, so it's Sunday through Friday, 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. And that's required as part of the DOT contract that this plant will be fulfilled. To produce asphalt, rock, sand, and asphalt cement are blended, heated, oil is added, and it's mixed. And you can have asphalt stored on site for 3 hours at about 300 degrees to answer the question about at what point oil leaches. So here's the DOT site, or the project. It's the 35 million overlay project that the previous project was also, the C&D landfill was also a part of fulfilling. So this project starts in Polk County at Northeast 134th. It goes up to Highway 210 in Story County and ends at about 3.5 miles north of Highway 210, so just south of 290th in Story County. Here's the vicinity map of where the plant will be located, or is proposed to be located. Again, it's across the quarter line from that previous applicant. So up here is where the C&D was, approximately. And then you have Hallett's materials located here. That's what that little lake-like thing is. And then here's the subject property. So this is I-35, and this is U.S. Highway 30. Zoning surrounding land use map, you can see all adjacent parcels are zoned A1 agricultural. Again, here is Hallett's materials to the north. There are some commercial light industrial properties to the north as well as some A2 agribusiness zoning. But again, adjacent zoning is all A1 agricultural. The closest dwelling is over across 35, about 3/4 mile away. Here's the Ames Urban Fringe Plan designation. Again, like the previous request, this is designated natural area on the Ames Urban Fringe, and all adjacent parcels are as well. Here's the floodplain map for you. Again, this is in the floodplain AE designation. The floodway area is closer to the South Skunk River here. A floodplain development permit is also required for this project. Because it's in that 1% annual greater chance of flood, it's required all of the things that can be elevated are elevated 18 inches above floodplain level. And in this case, there won't be any anchoring. It will all be elevated. Any future temporary batch plants or materials that could be proposed for this site will need a separate floodplain development application and permit. This applicant also must submit the floodplain evacuation plan for the equipment on the site. That's a condition of approval and a condition of the floodplain permit. Yeah. And in this case, the applicant has provided that the equipment will be relocated to the Iowa DOT site, which is on 30 and just east of 35. We just had the cell tower application on that site, so you guys are pretty familiar with it. So that's where the equipment would go in the event of a flood. This is the site up close. It's 47.24 net acres. The plant will occupy 6 acres. The remaining, I guess it would be 87% of the parcel will be in agricultural use, continue to be farmed as part of a lease with the farmer. Here's the site plan. I know it's little, so I kind of go through it with you. This is the gravel drive. The engineer and the applicant met today, and it will actually be 40 feet wide to accommodate truck traffic, not 32 as indicated on the site plan. Here is a 66 by 10 gravel parking area with 11 spaces. This is a recycled asphalt stockpile that will be 10 feet high. These two stockpiles to the east and the south are made of topsoil, or proposed to be made of topsoil, and those will be planted. They're also 10 feet in height, and I think the grasses that will be planted on them will be 3 or 4 feet in height. So that will provide some screening of the plant, which is, on average, the equipment's 10 to 15 feet in height. This is the pad on which that portable plant will be located. It's gravel. It's 40,000 square feet. This is additional stockpiling area here of limestone sand and other materials they need to produce the asphalt. The total impervious surface area, if you count the gravel, the stockpiles, those impervious surfaces, the actual planted area with the topsoil stockpiles that will be planted equals 33% of the impervious surfaces. We require landscaping of 20%, so they're exceeding the code requirement if we're counting the topsoil planted stockpiles as the landscaping that's required when you create gravel surfaces. The batch plant itself, it is permitted by the Iowa DNR. They are required to have an air quality construction permit. They also have to have an NPDES, National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit through the DNR. And as per Story County requirements, they've provided us with both of those applications. They're in the process of getting those. The temporary asphalt plant includes several tanks for fuel, a control house, a silo for storage of the asphalt. There's a loading area for the trucks under the asphalt silos. And there are several trailers that are part of the plant as well. The plant stack on the baghouse, which is for dust control, and the asphalt silo are approximately 40 feet. But again, most of the other equipment is 10 to 15 feet. They did provide dimensions and height of all the equipment and fuel tanks and that kind of thing, which is on the next slide. So here's a fuel tank. Here's another tank. And there is one more fuel tank, or AC tanks over here. Those range from 6,000 to 12,500 gallons. This is the approximate layout of the plant, although it's mobile. It could change once it's on the site. But here are those trailers down here for the lab, the trucker's lounge. This is the silo where loading will occur underneath of it, so it's 39 feet in height. There's some more lime silos over here and some bins that feed into the drum for processing. And then there's a recycle bin over here as well. These are the site photos. So we're at approximately the access point that's existing on the site, looking west. Now we're looking south. There is a farm to the south, but there's no dwelling on that farm. Here's looking east. You can kind of see Interstate 35. Back here. Looking north, and now we're at the south end of the property, so that's an existing tree line. And looking north from the northeast from the southern end, you can kind of see 560th here. Moving into our standards of approval, compatibility. Our Story County Land Development Regulations require that this type of use, a batch plant, is adjacent to an extraction site. And it is in this case. And that's for a variety of reasons, but the applicant has stated that they will actually be obtaining materials from that site, which is useful. And then they will also be obtaining materials from Martin Marietta, so local materials. Again, the northwestern 6 acres of the parcel are the only portion that will be occupied by the plant. Everything else will remain in agriculture, and there's really no single-family dwellings or non-ag or extraction uses in the vicinity. The second standard of approval, transition. There are, again, those berms on the south and east side of the site that are 10 feet in height and will be planted with grasses. There's an existing tree line on the north side of the site, and those are pretty established trees. The height of the plant stack and asphalt silos are approximately 40 feet, so you might be able to see those from 35 or other areas. But again, it is temporary. And again, I don't think I mentioned this before, but it's approximately 0.2 miles to Interstate 35 to the east from this plant site. Traffic. Again, we're going to need to expand that access to 40 feet to allow for truck traffic onto the property. The applicant anticipates 70 truckloads a day to and from the site. I will remind you, this is a night project, so while materials will be delivered and stockpiled during the day, the truck traffic to the actual project will occur at night. The DOT traffic counts for this area show 20 cars a day on 560th, but that will be increasing with the batch plant that's to the north in the city limits, and then you have the C&D construction and demolition site as well. So staff and the county engineer are recommending a condition that the applicant must restore the road to its original condition and maintain the road as necessary during the use. The engineer met with the applicant today to establish the current baseline condition of the road and maintenance needs, and the engineer will come back out at the end of the use to assess and give approval to allow them to leave, essentially. I will also mention that it's a similar haul route. It's a DOT-approved haul route. They use state highways. Given that the South Dayton exit's closed, they'll be using Duff as well as necessary to get onto 30 to exit down to the site. South Dayton is the only non-state road that will be used. It's an approved haul route already, though, for trucks. And the applicant stated that Henningsen Construction usually places a truck's turning sign on the site. That's pretty typical for this kind of thing. Parking and loading. The only loading that's going to occur is under an asphalt silo on the site, and that would be at night. There, again, are 11 spaces provided, and that, according to the applicant, is equivalent to the maximum number of employees on one shift. So we feel that's a pretty reasonable number. There wasn't really a standard in our parking code or parking table for maximum standards that addressed this kind of use. There were similar uses, and this is equivalent to those similar manufacturing. There was a research park use under industrial uses that required one space per maximum shift employee. The general public will not access or park on this site. There's no need for ADA-compliant parking. Parking lot stall sizes meets our Story County land development regulations. We do have a requirement that parking lots over 10 spaces have trees planted around the perimeter in a ratio of one tree for every five spaces. We are considering that established tree line as meeting this requirement. It's 20 feet to the north of the parking area, and given that this is a temporary use and in the floodplain, we think that is meeting that requirement. And then we also have the stockpiles and the topsoil stockpiles kind of providing screening for that parking area again, as well as the trees. Moving into the standard of signs and lighting, the lighting is approximately looks like this fixture. So there's four bulbs per fixture. So it's 440,000 total lumens. Our land development regulations allow lighting over 1,800 lumens if it will not emit above the horizontal plane at the lowest part of the bulb. This lighting is shielded. The applicant has stated that there will not be any horizontal shining of the light fixture, and they're not going to angle it towards the roadway to create glare. And there's a note on the site plan that lighting will be positioned based on an assessment of the site and the lighting needs. There are OSHA requirements for lighting on this site, given that it's a night work site. And so we feel, staff feels, that they meet the lighting requirements. Additionally, given that the property to the north of the site is an extraction use and everything else is in an agricultural use that's adjacent, we don't anticipate any negative impacts from the light. Environmental protection. Henningsen did provide their emergency plan and stormwater protection plan, and that goes through inspections that they do daily of the tanks, the lines, the pumps. Also, standards for keeping stockpile materials separate, oil changing areas clean, and just generally checking for potential spills, that kind of thing. They also, again, have an air quality permit from the Iowa DNR, which requires the bag house's control equipment. Also regarding dust control, the contractor said they would water the gravel pad and the road each night prior to production, so staff recommends making that a condition of approval. All emissions that will come from this plant are regulated by the DNR, and set for requirements for emission standards. Again, they have that air quality permit. Regarding stormwater and environmental protection in terms of erosion control, those sorts of things. The applicant has identified that maintaining the open space around the plant is a best management practice. following the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual and SUDA specifications, which is what our code requires them to do, follow those best management practices. And again, they provided that given that the pad is gravel and the parking is gravel and given the open space surrounding the plant, most stormwater and erosion will leave the area via evapotranspiration and infiltration. And again, they have those berms there, and those are expected to have a minimal impact on stormwater as well. They will have erosion control fencing. I can go back and show you that on the site plan if you want. And that will remain until the grass and plantings on the disturbed portions of the site are in place. The applicant, again, has provided copies of the NPDES permits. We asked about noise and odor on the site, which is an environmental concern. No crushing will occur, and no odor is anticipated. Staff was concerned about maybe an egg-like smell related to sulfur. But that, again, is regulated as an emission by the air quality permit. Again, the floodplain development permit is required to be obtained by our code. And overall, given that it is a temporary use adjacent to an extraction use and agricultural uses, no excessive environmental impacts are anticipated. So these points of analysis, if you conclude that all the above standards of approval are met, you also must conclude that there's a strong possibility the development will not adequately safeguard health, safety, welfare, those kinds of things. Again, no adjacent single-family dwellings. Impair adequate supply of quality and light, of light and air to surrounding properties. They have that air quality permit. There's other dust control and emission measures in place. Unduly increased congestion on roads. The South Dayton Avenue area is the traffic south of Highway 30 is already primarily related to that extraction use with trucks hauling there. It's an improved haul route. 70 truck trips per day are anticipated, again, but some will be at night. And we do have that condition from the engineer to restore the roadway and maintain it. Cannot impair or establish or impair established property values. Assessor's office had no concerns that they shared with us through interagency review. And finally, not be in accord with the intent, purpose, or spirit of the land development regulations or cornerstone to capstone plan. Again, this is in the Ames urban fringe area, similar policies to what Emily went over earlier with that natural area designation. So, for instance, the rural urban transition area, policy number 4 comes into play here, where we permit interim development to occur in a manner that will support long-term urbanization of the Ames urban fringe. There's other natural resource standards and policies in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, including mitigating net negative impacts to natural areas. We feel that the NPDES permit that they will obtain, erosion control measures, plantings on the berms, those kind of things, air quality permits meet this standard. And finally, Ames Urban Fringe Policy 1.5.3 states that when development is allowed in the floodplain, which with a floodplain development permit would be in this case, it's required to be elevated, which it would be 18 inches above the floodplain level, and it's located outside of the floodway, which it is. We had several comments from the interagency review team. Floodplain manager, again, provided comments. They established the requirement that they would need to go through the types of materials and equipments on the site, provide an evacuation plan, elevate all equipment and materials 18 inches above the base flood elevation level. Again, the floodplain permit will only be granted if the Board of Adjustment approves the conditional use permit. And if any recycled asphalt is to remain on site in case there's future temporary plants, they would need separate floodplain development permits for those to remain on the site. Planning and development also had several comments on other permits that they need if the conditional use permit is granted. We kind of went through those already. emergency management reviewed the documents, especially the condition that they provide a flood evacuation plan. As a general guideline, the emergency management director commented, "It floods in Ames approximately 8 to 10 hours after a heavy rain event starts flooding in Story City." So while we do not have hard documentation on this timeline, it might be a metric we use to evaluate whether their evacuation plan is sufficient, and it will be up to the applicant to establish those parameters and monitor during flooding events to determine when they need to evacuate. We will not notify them. Assessor's office just had comments on the temporary nature of the use and temporary structures and how those would be not change the classification of the land. We did receive several comments from the public. Don Truman, who was here earlier, was concerned about the impacts of the development on the floodplain and flooding on highways 30 and 69, like he spoke about earlier. And we also received a letter from F. Richard Lyford, attorney on behalf of Manico Corporation. And the letter advised that Manico may seek to prevent the sale of the property to Joe Manat and the Manat Group, LLC. The purchase of the property is currently the subject of a dispute around who has the right to acquire the property. I have provided you with a copy of the letter at each one of your stations up there. If you care to take a look at it. But again, the application submission came with letters allowing the applicant to apply for this on behalf of the property owner and Henningsen, and that meets our code, the requirements of our code. We provided information to Ames and Gilbert, as they're in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. The City of Ames said they had no comments, and Gilbert has not provided their comments. Points to consider, again, it's a temporary use. Any impacts are temporary in nature, and this temporary use will help support long-term growth and development in the Ames area. We do require batch plants to be adjacent to extraction facilities. There are two main extraction facilities in Story County. You have Martin Marietta, you have Hallett's Materials. This one's adjacent to Hallett's Materials. The Hallett's Materials area is further from residential areas than Martin Marietta would be. It's also closer to the repaving project and potentially future repaving projects with I-35 and 30. And again, the floodplain development permit is required for the temporary batch plant, including a flood evacuation plan. Separate floodplain development permits would be required if any stockpiled materials remained on site or the gravel pad after this plant is removed. And any future proposed temporary batch plants would also require separate floodplain development permits, and I will also note separate conditional use permits or modifications if this conditional use permit has not expired. So our recommendation is to approve or recommend approval to the Board of Adjustment with conditions. The conditions are that this current proposed batch plant be removed by November 30th. Gives them 30 days after October, and they said they would be done. I also noted as a condition, if no new batch plant is proposed to operate the site within a year of the date of removal, the conditional use permit will expire. And so they'll have to apply for new conditional use permits for future proposed temporary batch plants. The applicant must submit a flood evacuation plan to be reviewed by the county's floodplain manager and emergency management director as part of their floodplain development permit. And a separate floodplain development permit will be required for the pad and stockpiles if they are to remain after the removal of the plant. The applicant shall restore the road to its original condition and maintain the road as necessary. Again, this condition includes the engineer meeting with the applicant before and after this plant is installed to establish baseline conditions of the road and inspect the road. And finally, the applicant shall water the gravel pad and roadway to prevent excess dust as needed. So these are the alternatives. Again, we recommend alternative 2. Any questions?
I do have a couple. So oil is required for this process.
Mm-hmm.
how much oil will be on site and how will it be stored? And I might have missed it. I think your website's down because I was trying to look in the application.
So there's a fuel tank that's 12,000 gallons. There are AC tanks, and there's off-road number 2 tanks. So these could also contain recycled fuel oil and diesel. And those are 6,000 gallons and 12,500 gallons each, those AC tanks are. Does that kind of help clarify?
So, and I know that we're not designing the flood evacuation plan here, but I am curious how within that amount of time all of that oil would be removed from that site.
Mm-hmm.
Between 6 and 8 hours?
8 to 10.
Or 8 to 10.
So it's stored how?
So the entire plant is portable.
It's all portable.
It's designed to be mobile.
Okay.
The tanks are separate, but those, again, are on the pad that's elevated first off. And then everything the applicant has stated will be removed as part of that evacuation plan, even the portable toilet. Nothing's going to be anchored. We're not going to leave fuel on the site.
What's the plan?
That's the plan.
Yeah.
That was something that the emergency management division was very concerned about, making sure that that would be addressed.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine.
In the event of a flood.
Mm-hmm. That's the difference between this and the previous application in terms of being on the floodplain. If there were a flood, the previous one, you said, ground depth asphalt, not a problem, it doesn't reach, it doesn't turn liquid until 300 degrees, but this, you've got liquid there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
They've indicated it's achievable to remove these items.
I will also say that they have provided a lot of information on the hazardous materials that are on the site, and that information will get provided to emergency responders, I believe. For instance, the material safety data sheets I just got from the applicant, that's like 100 pages on the potential impacts, what's on the site. We also received the Tier 2 hazardous materials, which are required to be reported, and we have routed those to the emergency management director as well in the department.
Other questions for Scott? And like to address us. Step up to the podium and name and address, please.
My name is Joe Manat. My address is 147 34th Street, Des Moines, Iowa. To address the two questions, how much oil is on site? I think that was answered. And how is it stored? It's stored as a hot liquid. It's stored at 300 degrees. At an ambient temperature, asphalt does not go anywhere. It's solid. And the maximum amount of oil on site, and we'll do this with our, we'll handle this with our floodplain permit and evacuation plan. According to those, a tanker load is about 3,000 gallons, 3 to 5,000, I guess, depends on the truck. So we can get all that oil out of there with, if you get the right trucks, 5 trucks, maybe. AC stands for asphalt cement, by the way, and it's stored hot, it's transported hot, and the nearest facility is in Des Moines, so it's 30 miles away. So that's where this would go in the event that there is a flood. And you can actually haul, this is a highly portable plant. These guys will take this around to the state 5-6 places a year. You just back under all these pieces, you disconnect the hoses and go to your next site. So we're only hauling it to the DOT shed maintenance facility on Highway 30, so that's only a mile or so away. So we're expecting it to be pretty quick in the event of a flood. I should note, too, that the elevation is going to be 18 inches above the BFE. So, and we're also in a flood plain. We're not in the flood way. So I don't expect anything to be rolling down the riverbed, and we're also on the east side of the road, so we're hoping all those things help mitigate any flood risk. But we will handle that when we develop our evacuation plan and our floodplain development permit.
Questions for Ashley?
Thank you.
Thank
you. Time.
We may come up. We may come up with some. Yeah. Okay. I have a public comment on this application. Is anyone here who wants to speak to the issue? I don't see any, but I would like to just real briefly address the letter from the attorney, just to be absolutely clear and for the record. You do have written authorization from the current owner of the property to apply for this permit.
You want to see it? I have it, yes.
Yes, I believe
you. Okay. You have letters from the property owner, from the applicant, and from the construction company.
Okay. And from the current owner, not a proposed owner, not okay.
Doris M. Plath and Doris M. Plath, Revocable Trust.
Okay, thanks. Any more questions? Let's take action.
I would move to recommend approval of CUP 05-17 with staff conditions and place it on the Board of Adjustment agenda for June 21st, 2019.
We have a motion by Holston. Is there a second?
A second.
Second by Sherwood. Any discussion on the motion? Can we get a roll call, please?
Cable.
Yes.
Sherwood.
Yes.
Steele.
Yes.
Holstrom.
Yes.
Merkin.
Yes.
The application advances. Thanks for coming in tonight. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And we're up to town comments.
We had an open house on May 23rd. At Pinal, at the seed company. And Linda was there, and Linda may have some comments about that. Board of Supervisor, Marty Chitty was there, staff was there. We actually had a little over 30 property owners respond, so it was very well attended. We were very pleased. And we were there for about an hour, hour and a half, and we provided basically three different ways to provide input to us. One was verbally. We had quite a few people provide verbal comments, which we wrote down on the whiteboard. We had cards that they could use if they wanted to provide a confidential comment to us. And we also had a large aerial that they could point out different issues or concerns. All told, we received probably about 20 comments, ranging from stormwater drainage concerns, which that was probably the most intensive type comment, issues with roads, patching, concerns about a few construction projects, which we've already started to respond to. Those are really the main issues with septic systems. We actually met today. Environmental Health Department was there. Margaret James was there. Darren Moon was there from Engineering Secondary Roads and provided input and responded to some of the comments and questions that we received. But we actually met this afternoon to try to kind of go over the various comments that we received. Haley and Amelia put together like a spreadsheet to identify what the comments were and what department would be most appropriate to respond to them. And so we kind of went through those. We're trying to figure out what things we can deal with administratively to take action on right away and what items that we received really are of a nature that's beyond maybe our current maybe staff level or budget levels. And I think most of it we're able to deal with administratively. We did, like I said, map the comments. Richland is the east-west street, the north-south street.
It's Winchester.
Most of the stormwater drainage comments were south of Richland, again, which is the east-west street. and Darren provided some input on this, and we're interested in more of a comprehensive approach to try to, you know, look at this issue instead of dealing with each specific drainage issue. But he threw out some information about potential cost and, you know, what would actually be involved to really do this the right way. And so we kind of dealt with that. We've got some information from an outside source, which is
the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship Soil and Water Conservation District. They have an urban conservationist that looks at different green infrastructure solutions, and they've offered to come out and look at Fernald, go over what our map says for free and
no cost,
make some recommendations on potential practices that don't involve making a storm sewer or island.
So we'll likely take them up on that,
yeah,
and assess after that. But we communicated with the residents there that we would probably be back within 30 to 60 days to try to, you know, kind of go over the responses, and hopefully by that time we'll have addressed many of the issues, concerns, complaints. And then I think the biggest issue is going to be the stormwater drainage problems that they have. And then hopefully by that time, well, we'll come to the Planning and Zoning Commission, because this is something that's on our work program, come to the Planning and Zoning Commission with, you know, what our plan is to address it. But Linda, you were there. Do you have any comments?
I was surprised at the number of people who were there, and nobody seemed to have a real axe to grind at all, which was good. Darren and Margaret did a good job of providing information. I'm not sure one gentleman was led. Here's some of the information that Margaret gave him, but the gentleman that seemed to have the most problems or concerns about drainage lived outside of the drainage district that's there, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So that means
on the south side of town?
Yeah, southeast, I thought he was, in the drainage district. Okay. Was there the west side of the street?
Yeah.
There was one, too, that the drainage district boundary changed, so Darren thought maybe there might be a way to actually help this person out because of this district realignment.
But a lot of the pooling on that gentleman's property looks like it's happening along the road right of way. Mm-hmm. We kind of talked to Darren about solutions just in that area. A lot of these are on private property. You know, you're pooling in the middle of someone's backyard.
And there's spilling going on. There's a railroad right away to the western portion of this unincorporated village, and you've got people putting sheds back there, doing some fill. But the railroad will allow that if you provide, like, if you enter into a lease agreement, they'll allow you to store maybe like a small little shed or put vehicles back there through their lease agreement. So they allow some of that. So we're going to try, have to get a handle on what the railroad permits in that type of situation.
I was surprised that people weren't more concerned about those grain elevators.
There was one comment made about removing them, but nobody that was there owned that comment.
And I was surprised too that our host actually owns one of the grain elevators.
She says, okay.
So it's kind of viewed, they're viewed kind of as a landmark feature too, so there's a lot of pride in seeing that they see.
Right. Got a lot
people
of
like
them.
So you'll be hearing more about that from us.
Or commission comments? No? Transportation update, was that helpful?
That was nice.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, thanks for rounding them up. Appreciate it. All right, there's no commission comments. We have a motion to adjourn.
Second.
We're adjourned. Thank you, Scott.